my name is Tom Schick. You're listening to the Quarter to Three Movie Podcast, where this week we will be discussing Greenberg.
Are those your feet, Tom?
It's a little Spanish foot dance that I do.
It's hot.
Are we at Starbucks right now?
I am joined. That right there was Christian Malinsky.
It's Miller.
Wait, is this a child?
I am also here with Kelly Wand. Kelly, do you have a tagline for us this week?
R.I.P. Corey Haim. Don't worry, he's with his career now.
Wow. That was brutal but good. And wow, Kelly Wand, way to open tough.
Yeah. Well, because Greenberg brings that out of me.
That's what Kelly Wand, can you tell us what happened in Greenberg? Break down the plot of this movie.
Oh, yeah. Greenberg. All right. Well, there were some things I didn't follow about it, but it's this guy named Greenberg, and he's 40, and he's a carpenter. And he's done nothing for 15 years since he blew a record deal for himself and his friends. He should have replaced him with Hagar, but instead they broke up because the band was called Greenberg. So he's getting over this 15-year period of stasis by doing nothing for a while. But he's easily bored, so he amuses himself by writing angry letters to disinterested corporations and hooking up with his family's personal assistant, who's blonde, named Florence, who's watching his brother's house while they're fighting Viet Cong on vacation.
Okay, good. And how does it all end?
It all works out in a twist ending that only Tom saw coming because he counted the number of times Greenberg's knocked unconscious. Because Florence is having an abortion and Greenberg is less hassle, even high maintenance, than the shipwreck she usually goes out with.
Okay, good. Good. Dingus, do you have anything to add to that?
That was one of your most coherent summaries ever.
Yeah, I was pretty disappointed that it was awfully coherent.
It was great.
Really?
I now understand the movie, so thank you. I thought she got a DNC, but apparently she got an abortion.
What's this got to do with the Democratic National Committee?
Very good. who here...
That was very good. You're right.
You are totally on tonight.
Look, I mean, Greenberg.
Kelly, can you name other Noah Baumbach movies?
I saw one this week because I wanted to bone up, as it were.
You did some homework.
I did. So I saw, or it was two movies. One was called The Squid and one was called The Whale.
And you had not... you had not seen that, I take it. So that
no, and it was great. And I have to say, I always hate this podcast, but I have to admit, it's led me to a lot of good films, like Squid and the Whale. And I can see where Wes Anderson took this guy under his wing, because they're kind of similar. He's like the new Wes Anderson, right?
I can see the similarities, but they're so distinct in terms of subject matter. They're so distinct in terms of tone. And I think they're basic world outlooks. I see Noah Baumbach, and I'm not even sure if I'm saying his name correctly. He seems a lot to have a much darker outlook. There's a deeper streak of misanthropy and stuff. Yeah.
But he also wears his heart on his sleeve, like Wes Anderson does. They both have that. So he's like the dark Wes Anderson.
Yeah,
which makes him the perfect Wes Anderson.
There's an absence of what, Dingus?
Whimsy, is what I was going to say.
Yes.
He's not the new Wes Anderson. He's the nude Wes Anderson.
Who here has seen every single movie that he has directed? I'm raising my hand. Anyone else? So we'll go down the list. Did anyone here see Kicking and Screaming, which is sort of Noah Baumbach doing a Whit Stillman movie? Okay, I'm the only one who saw that.
I saw that.
Oh, you saw that? Okay, Dingus.
His hand was up.
I'm raising my hand.
Oh, okay. Well, you're awfully short, so I couldn't tell. Did you see, who here saw Mr. Jealousy, which was sort of
is that Eric Stoltz?
Yeah, and it's really, it almost has some whimsy to it.
And green is the color of jealousy?
It's played for comedy. Yeah, that is correct.
So, is it good? Is Mr. Jealousy good?
No, I think it's easily his worst movie. It's wacky. It tries to be wacky. Although it does have a great line where Eric Stoltz realizes. So his girlfriend is Annabella Sciorra, and she has a previous boyfriend who's a successful writer. And one reason, again, it's Noah Baumbach doing his Whit Stillman stuff. It's Christopher Eichmann? No, I'm thinking of one of the Nazis. Christopher Eichmann? Eicher? What's the guy's name? Someone help me.
From Barcelona?
Yeah. Is it Eichmann, or I'm thinking of, this famous Nazi? Yeah, that's, I'm confusing him with the famous Nazi, I think.
I think his name's Kissinger.
He's a famous Nazi. That's awesome.
Anyway, Eric Stoltz gets jealous of her previous boyfriend, and so befriends the boyfriend, and shenanigans ensue.
That sounds good.
Well, but Eigerman. It ends. Eigerman?
Eigerman, yeah.
Okay, now who was the famous Nazi?
Ehrlichman?
Oh, very good. Okay. That wasn't even close. So anyway, shenanigans ensue, and there's a great line, and it's an instance, I think, of how Noah Baumbach, his dialogue can just be just fantastic sometimes. There's a great line at the end of Mr. Jealousy, and I'm going to butcher it because I don't remember exactly how it goes, but where Eric Stoltz observes, because he's an obsessive, jealous boyfriend, that he has become the thing he hates the most, and that is namely one of his girlfriend's exes. So now that I've ruined that reveal, there's no.
It's reason. Like the opposite of what was that movie where about the drug dealer who saw the hot girl who was the daughter of his shrink. Came out last year.
Scarface.
That was a sort of a subplot, wasn't it, on that Bored to Death TV show with Jason Schwartzman, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know exactly what movie you're talking about, Kelly.
But he has a line at the end. That's the dark backwards. That's what I want to call it. The whackness. That's something.
Oh God, you're right. Wow.
It's like the reverse whackness, where at the end he tells her, like cheerfully, well, not cheerfully, but like thoughtfully, like, yeah, you broke my heart. Like that'll be your place in my pantheon.
Right.
Says so like he's learned from it.
Who was the girl in the whackness?
Oh God, she was amazing.
Was it Olivia Thirlby?
Yes.
She is great. She is. Speaking of, real quick.
Remember that scene in the shower where she kind of, like, turns off of him? She goes, dude. Like, he goes, I love you.
Yeah.
So good. Love that movie.
So the new Olivia Thirlby, by the way, is an actress named Kat Dillinger, who I just saw in a movie called Defendor with Woody Harrelson, which isn't very good. But Kat Dillinger, she is so good. I will watch anything she's in, and she's from Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist, in a movie you love, Dingus, Charlie Bartlett School Therapist, or whatever that thing was. So let's get back
Dingus
to...
Dingus is a Michael Cera apologist, isn't he?
I think we all are on this podcast, aren't we?
Well, Jesse Eisenberg's the rich man's Michael Cera, based on Squid and the Whale.
So that's something, too, about these Noah Baumbach movies, is you can always see... It's sort of like Ben Stiller was doing... A Jesse Eisenberg kind of performance, wasn't it?
Yeah, but well.
Yeah. I don't mean that as a criticism.
No, I don't think that. What are you talking about?
It's the Noah. It's the quintessential character stand-in for Noah Baumbach, who I imagine is very much like that. The little kid in Margot at the Wedding, Ben Stiller in Greenberg, and Jesse Eisenberg in The Squid and the Whale. It's the Jewish kid with the shock of long dark hair, who is very neurotic and has a sort of a severe, striking face.
He's
our main character. Although it's interesting, Margot at the Wedding, I think, and Squid and the Whale. One of my observations about Greenberg, I think it's part of a trilogy in a way, and you can see it with Squid and the Whale and with Margot at the Wedding, and I'll ask about Margot and the Wedding in a minute. But you can see the same character at different stages in this brutal cycle of children becoming their parents.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of like Greenberg is after he's moved beyond that. I don't think there's a lot about his parents necessarily in Greenberg.
No.
But you can see almost that he is going to end up marrying Florence, and they are going to become the Jeff Daniels and Laura Linney to their children.
I like it. So it's a prequel.
it's a cyclical trilogy.
It's like the Super Troopers sequel.
I like it. I don't see that happening, but I like where you're going. And I, by the way, I think the character that Ben Stiller is playing is far too stricken. I mean, he's just got this stricken quality to him that is far beyond what we see in what you're talking about for Jesse Eisenberg. But I guess you could sort of stretch it and see it as the character at a different stage of his life. But I don't know. And I don't know if I can sign on for that.
Okay, well, me and Kelly Wand are going that way. Kelly Wand,
yeah,
by
but
the way,
there's differences, though, because he's a guy, there's a huge age difference thing,
right,
which doesn't really apply to Laura Linney and Jeff Daniels. And he's more likable than the Jeff Daniels character, I think. He's just going through some shit.
Well, before we talk about that, I'm curious, Kelly Wand, because I know, Dingus, you've seen Margot at the Wedding. Kelly Wand, have you seen Margot at the Wedding?
No, I don't see movies with wedding in the title.
Okay. I will just float this and we can talk about it later. I love Greenberg. I'm guessing we all did, but I think Margot at the Wedding is a better movie.
So is it also Baumbach? Irma Baumbach?
Yeah. It's the movie he did right before Greenberg.
Ah.
And it's with Nicole Kidman, Jennifer Jason Leigh, who's tremendous in it. And by the way, one of the notable things about Margot at the Wedding, and I think you're with me on this, Dingus, it is a rare, non-annoying Jack Black performance. I think he's very, very good in Margot at the Wedding. And he assumes that mantle, kind of the Noah Baumbach stand-in character.
Yeah, it leads right into his work in Brutal Legend, I would say.
Well, there are...
I would...
Go ahead, Dingus.
Seamlessly.
I would have to disagree with you. I agree that I loved Greenberg. You're right about your opinion about me loving Greenberg. But you are, I think, incorrect that that Margot at the Wedding is a better film. And we're just going to, you know, we've talked about this before. We're just going to disagree about that. I think that Greenberg gets the balance of meanness and longing and hope correct. And I think Margot at the Wedding does not.
One of the reasons that I want to highlight Margot at the Wedding, and one of the reasons I think – one of the things that I think it offers that Greenberg doesn't offer are a variety of really well-drawn characters interacting with each other in a way that we don't get with Greenberg. Greenberg is about one guy at a sort of an isolated moment in his life basically meeting a girl, whereas Margot at the Wedding is about really rich, intricate family dynamics. It's – you know, maybe it's the difference between Chekhov and, I don't know, a play about one dude.
It's between The Godfather and The Conversation,
which is the difference between Chekhov and Sulu.
And also, I think one thing that Margot at the Wedding has that Greenberg doesn't have, and Greenberg's a very different movie, Margot at the Wedding has this really well-crafted sense of dread. It's almost literary, the way that Margot and the Wedding is built around this concept of this childhood tree that is going to fall over and ruin the wedding. And the whole metaphor of – and it's not even a metaphor because Nicole Kidman literally climbs the tree and gets stuck in it. And she gets a bug lodged in her ear. And there's these evil neighbors with a dead pig and the weird, uncomfortable situation with a teenage babysitter. I mean, there's a lot more – I think detail and variety in Margot at the Wedding. It's a grander movie, I would say. And also the performances. I really like Ben Stiller, and I loved Greta Gerwig, and we'll talk about this in a minute. Mm. But the performances in Margot at the Wedding are really top-notch. I mean, the scenes with Nicole Kidman and Jennifer Jason Leigh are just so – both of those actresses are just firing on all cylinders, working off of each other so well. And so anyway, yeah, so we can disagree about which is a better movie, but they are very different movies. And I think what Margot at the Wedding does is more ambitious and therefore manages to achieve a little bit more than Greenberg. So Kelly wants to see Margot at the Wedding and break this tie.
Well, Greenberg's really good and I will.
Go ahead, Dingus. I'm sorry.
I'm curious because I think that the Greta Gerwig performance in this, the character and the performance, are really something that's lacking from Margot at the Wedding. And I don't know if you can address that. I understand what you're saying about the actresses and the them firing on all cylinders and the family dynamic in that. But I think that there's an awkward charm to Greta Gerwig's performance in Green Book that really saves the movie in some ways. It's not that the movie was going to tank or anything, but it's just such a charming performance in such a difficult performance, and I just fell in love with it. And you wouldn't see a lot of directors cast this particular actress to play this part, and I'm so happy they did. And I just don't see that in Margot at the Wedding. And in Margot at the Wedding, I understand what you're saying about it, but it just left a bad taste in my mouth. I don't think it's a bad film. It just I had a harder time with it than I had with this one.
Huh. Well, there's no equivalent to, I mean, the little boy who, one of the things that Noah Baumbach has to do is he's making movies basically about assholes, about guys who are real jerks, and you can't really just have a movie about just that guy. So he'll put against that jerk somebody who's basically suffering or almost being abused at the hands of that person, right. And it highlights the jerkiness of that person.
But they keep putting up with them, so.
Right, and that's sort of the dynamic. That's what Jesse Eisenberg does in Squid and the Whale. That's what Greta Gerwig does in Green Book. And the little boy they have doing that in Margot at the Wedding, he's on the verge of puberty, and he's an awkward little kid, and he has no idea what to make of his mother. So the dynamic's a little different. You don't have as fully realized a character dealing with that, and he's certainly not as good as Jesse Eisenberg. So yeah, I'll grant you that, Dinkus. I mean, there's nothing to really sympathize with. There's nobody really pulling at your heart in Margot at the Wedding like there is in Green Book and in Squid and the Whale.
But there's also a totally different dynamic when you're dealing with how a child has to choose to be involved in their parents' life as opposed to how a young woman and the reasons she chooses to be involved in a man's life.
Right.
I mean, those are obvious. That's an obvious different dynamic. And so the choices that she makes, and again, the character choice and the actress choice is totally winning for me.
Why do you say she wouldn't normally be cast in this movie? Because I thought that was an excellent casting choice. I can't imagine. And I noticed on IMDb, she's got several other projects coming up. I think she's like a new hotness, isn't she?
Well, she's a brilliant casting choice, but she's not sort of the Hollywood body type. And in the hands of a more popular, less talented director, you would have a hotter female.
Oh yeah, yeah.
That was uglied down. You'd have Cameron Diaz who was made to look ugly, instead of a girl who is not ugly by any means. But we're not hiding her skin blemishes, and we're not hiding her body type. And in fact, we're commenting on it, and that's fine. And it makes her more attractive to me and to him. I mean, he comments on that. I'm not attracted to the girls in L.A. He says that. And usually, a character in this type of film says that, but she's still a hot girl, and we're just supposed to cloud. So that's what I meant by that. She's perfect. She's perfectly cast. But
I think that's right. And I think that though, is something that Noah Baumbach does very well. You know, like the girl who plays the I Wish You Didn't Have So Many Freckles in The Squid and the Whale. She's got a little of that dynamic going as well. He's definitely not doing traditional casting. I love that about him. By the way, Dinkus and Kelly Wand, when you guys see, I realized how I recognized Greta Gerwig. She plays the sort of like bad friend in House of the Devil. And one of the early moments in House of the Devil where I was like, this movie is awesome, is the lead actress and Greta Gerwig just eating pizza, hanging out, talking to each other. So there's another reason for you guys to see House of the Devil. It's an early Greta Gerwig appearance.
I've got another connection for you guys with Greta Gerwig.
Okay.
If you're up for it. She's in another movie that I have not seen. It's called Baghead. And it was directed by a guy named Mark Duplass. And Mark Duplass is in Green Book. He plays the guy sitting on the couch with the beer who's the guy whose party that they've gone to for the kids' party.
You know that stuff just dries your lips out.
Yeah, that's the guy. And he's in a movie that I don't know how you guys are going to react to it, but I think you should see it called Hump Day. And so Mark Duplass, he directed this, I think, wrote it with his brother, and she was in this movie. I have no idea what the line of succession is or how she winds up in this movie and he winds up in Green Book 2. And then he directed her in this obscure movie called Baghead. But he's a really interesting talent. I really liked him in this. And if you get a chance, it's on instant view on Netflix. If you have it, you should probably see Hump Day.
So, Kelly Wand, if you ever go to a movie with Dingus, one of the ways to know when Dingus recognizes like an actor is he'll like shift in his seat or he'll make some vocalization like, oh, you know, because Dingus, I meant to ask you, why did you do your reaction at that guy in that party scene?
I didn't do that. I have such a great poker face. I don't want to do that.
That sounds distracting because you're looking for faces all the time.
It's totally annoying to go to a movie with me, but I was very, very excited to see him because
I'm going to say it's distracting for you, like you're looking at the faces. And
I'm totally distracted by myself. But that's okay. I was very excited to see this guy. He was in this obscure little movie, and he was very good in it. It's an odd movie. It's kind of tough to watch. but it was great to see him pop up, and he was really good in this little part.
Yeah, I'm glad, because I meant to ask you about that, Dingus, because we saw Greenberg together, and I need to remember to ask Dingus who that guy is and why he reacted. Good to know.
Right, because we weren't allowed to talk about anything afterwards.
So Greta Gerwig is in Baghead, not Hump Day.
No, yeah.
Greta Gerwig's in House of the Devil, not Hump Day, I thought.
Correct. Right. Baghead's a horror movie, by the way. You know that, don't you, Dingus?
I know very little about it because I haven't seen it, so yeah. I would just probably rent it and watch it.
Does it tap into our fear of bags?
You're joking, Kelly Wand, but yes. All right, let's get back to Greenberg. So
yeah.
Let's talk a bit about... So how difficult is it to watch a movie about – here's why I ask this. I want to ask how difficult is it to watch a movie about a jerk? And the reason I want to ask is I remember my mother watching Sideways and then afterwards saying, I hated that movie. I didn't like those guys. And me thinking, well, what – you don't – when you watch a movie, the character doesn't have to be likable. That's not necessarily the point of a movie. But I think that can be hard for some people. So
Giamatti was likable in Sideways. She didn't like Paul Giamatti's character. She thought he was a jerk.
I think, well, you know, he's like, yeah.
Madsen.
I mean, to us, you know, we're like middle-aged guys. We can understand that sort of thing. And I don't know, maybe my mom had no sympathy for midlife crisis among schlubby.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's a comment on your dad, I think.
Could be. But so how much of a factor was that? How difficult is it? To watch something like Greenberg, where I feel the character is extremely unsympathetic. Thing is, I think you were sort of soft-pedaling what a jerk he was. Or maybe that was you, Kelly Wand, I forget.
I love jerks, and he was awesome. Mm-hmm. I mean, he had some pretty smooth moves. He was a smooth operator.
Boy, talk about, like, awkward sex scenes. What's going on my 3x3 of awkward sex scenes?
I love that sex scene.
Well, here's why I asked this.
I wouldn't even call it a sex scene.
Yeah. Whatever that was.
The Corona move. So smooth. I love Greenberg. Thank you, Greenberg, for teaching me something. He's the new mystery.
Shall we split the Corona?
Yeah. Oh, that's hot.
Do you hear a train?
Oh!
But the dynamic of presenting this, and I love how the movie opens with her, by the way. She's sort of the bookend for the movie. The dynamic of presenting this really adorable character who just has no sense of herself and who seems a little aimless and lost, and who is, I think she's gorgeous, Dingus. And you were talking before, I mean, like her body type and her skin bloom, she just looked so real and gorgeous, and she just had beautiful eyes. I thought she was a gorgeous actress. And she is so sympathetic. And then to see her...
fall for Greenberg.
Yeah.
It's painful.
I had a little bit of difficulty with that. Now, it didn't affect my enjoyment because, you know, that happens all the time.
She's learning. It's a valuable life lesson and about Greenberg.
But do you guys ever watch a movie like this and sort of instead of feeling for the main character and understanding Greenberg's plight, isn't it a little distracting to watch that and think she should really be with a nicer boy?
Well, she's going to learn that.
I hope
so. Or Greenberg will get nice. That's what we're really hoping. We're hoping he'll go, I was a total dick, and then they'll make up, which they kind of do. Right?
I don't think he's going to change. I think they're going to keep going back and forth. I think you see that throughout the film. I mean, there's a sense
from himself. Well, I guess it pitched a nerve for me because I'm kind of Greenberg-esque, so I'm rooting for Greenberg, everything to work out for him. Yeah. Like, oh, yeah, he's got her. He'll be fine now. He's got this 25-year-old bright, pleasant presence around him. She'll redeem it.
I think she needs more from him than he's going to be able to give. But I like the sense of hope at the end. I mean, there's a beautiful little moment there at the end where she's listening to the messages and she says, oh, this is you. And then you have the shot of his face. And there's sort of a confused sense of hope there. And it is quite lovely. But
and
I
hung up the painting. He's figured it out. That's him proving he's like the dude at the end of Sun Also Rises, where he takes the confident swim. He's like confidently hanging out with the kids.
But I think the problem with him is that he's never going to understand what he should have done. You know, I think, Kelly, you might be onto something with him doing the hanging the painting. But the key moment for me for this character, and we're sort of getting off of Tom's initial question, but I want to go here anyway, is his beautiful scene with Ivan, with Reese Erfans. Is that how you say his
name? Erfans. Isn't it just Reese Erfans?
Is that how you say it? Reese Erfans?
I believe so.
Is that beautiful scene with them at the party where Ivan shows up, and the last thing he says to him is, "You should have gotten to know Vic," and the only thing Greenberg can come up with is, "I'm sorry, I didn't follow the diminutive.
I didn't recognize the diminutive."
And it never would have occurred to him. It never would have occurred to him. He's missing something that he should have been a part of that little boy's life in order to establish a relationship with his friend or to be a part of that relationship with his friend. And I don't know that he can change in that way. And I think that basic human contact is what she's looking for.
And I really don't think it's hopeful at all because of things like that, Dingus. I mean, the fact that, you know, he is drug addled, there is that, but he's also a self-centered guy. I think it's another example, and it's why I think of this in a way as a trilogy. Noah Baumbach creating these portraits of characters who cannot redeem themselves, who cannot help themselves, who can't get out of these ruts that they're in. And I think that he is the little boy who was raised by by Nicole Kidman's character in Margo at the Wedding, whose parents broke up in Squid and the Whale, and who is going to become his own Jeff Daniels to his sons, you know, later in life, if that happens.
There's a reference to someone named Greenberg in Squid and the Whale. There's a throwaway line. So maybe it's an actual sequel and not just a spiritual.
It could be like Noah Baumbach's own Faulkner Potawa County kind of thing.
Yeah.
Could be, yeah. But I don't see it as hopeful. I mean, I see it as a pretty pessimistic movie, and I think Florence is sort of thrown into the teeth of this misanthropic asshole, and
yeah, but he ditched the Australian girls for her to show up at her apartment. Her painting up. That to me is optimistic.
See, the happy ending would have been him getting whisked away
to at the end of Manhattan.
Yeah. Well, like I said,
out of that car because he freaks out. He has a panic attack. It's not. And what I was talking about was hopeful. Is that I think the very last shot of the film is there is a look of hope on his face. That she's about to listen to this message that he left where he tells her he likes her. And that's really all he says in it that is of value, I would think, besides deconstructing the movie Wall Street, among other things.
She hasn't seen.
But he says he likes her twice in that message. And I think that he's looking forward to her hearing that. And that's all he's got to go on. So there's a look of hope on his face, but I don't think it's going to lead anywhere. And that's
yeah, she's hopeful, too, and she's accepted him. A little bit. I don't know.
She accepts him really early, too. I mean, she really early on is willing to look past a lot of jerk behavior.
Well, I think she just wants contact. I mean, you see that most obviously after that first sex scene where she reaches out for the boy's back or the guy's back after that one night stand. She just wants contact, and that's why she lets him make the pass and lets him go down on her immediately. And she just needs that touch, and she's impressed by him, and so she's between relationships and she's fragile. And so she needs this. And ultimately, I think it's going to be more, her needs are going to be more than he can possibly fulfill.
Right. And that's a terrible thing.
They'll have one good year and break up. And it'll be an awesome year. And then they can move on with their lives. And they'll both have grown from it. And she's 25. She'll spring back. Everything will be great. Greenberg's had a good year.
And I'm sure that Laura Linney, early on in her relationship with Jeff Daniels in Squid and the Whale, thought the same thing.
But they didn't have an age difference. And she'll go, Greenberg's 41 now.
They did actually have an age difference. She was a student of his in Squid and the Whale, if I'm not mistaken.
You're thinking of Natalie Portman. Sorry.
I'm always thinking of Natalie Portman.
One, two, three.
Natalie Portman. Anna Paquin.
That's what I meant to say.
Dingus.
I'm always thinking of Anna Paquin, too, simultaneously.
Nice retcon. To answer your earlier question, though, Tom, whether the characters are unlikable isn't going to sway me.
It makes it better. It makes it more watchable for me. I love unlikable.
Well, you know,
I'm way more fascinating. And, like, although you see them, I don't know. They're more interesting.
I mean, flawed characters are more interesting, and one very significant flaw in a character is he's a huge asshole. So,
right.
Yeah,
I identify with that, and I feel like I don't ask about my friends' kids enough. So when Reese Ifan, who, by the way, he's always like the wacky guy, Reese Ifan.
Oh, I so loved him not doing that. Yeah,
yeah, he's like, yeah, the voice of reason. He's like the good friend. He's the perfect friend.
He was so good. Yeah, and their scenes together were really good too. Yeah.
Yeah.
They were, and that last scene where they're together, I mean, it was the one time when I really felt like Ben Stiller wasn't quite rising to the occasion, because this guy was solid. He was just solid, and he wasn't doing anything extra. But now, Ben Stiller has a tough thing to do, because he's under the influence of drugs, and he's going nuts, and he's a little bit manic.
And he's Greenberg.
And he's Greenberg.
Right.
But Ivan was just so solid. In that moment, I loved that scene. When he first shows up at the gate, I'm like, why are you here? And then he's apologizing. It's like this embarrassed, I'm getting back with my wife. Your embarrassment to a friend who has stood up for you, but it's different from the way Gina stands up to Florence. It's just a beautiful scene. Beautiful. He's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There were a few times where there were, and most of the times it was when Ben Stiller was alone, where he was doing what I thought were sort of Ben Stiller-y gags that I could have done without. But for the most part, I really liked Ben Stiller as well.
Well, I think that's how you offset the idea of having a character who is an asshole or an unlikable character, because he's funny. I mean, the first thing he says is, there are people in the pool. And and so you immediately laugh. And if you're introduced to a character who makes you laugh, you're going to give him some leeway. And we like Ben Stiller anyway, or, you know, sometimes he wears on me, but as an audience whole, he's very popular, he's likable, and he's funny. So if you're going to have a guy who's an asshole but who is also funny, I think that works.
Well, you know, Dingus, did Chazzy do any funny stuff in Royal Tenenbaums? I think Ben Stiller was totally outside of himself playing Chazzy.
Yeah.
But that whole movie was like that. Everyone was outside themselves in that movie.
Well, no, as far as actors, as far as not really thinking, there were times in Greenberg, and it wasn't a big deal, but there were times in Greenberg where it's like, oh, that's Ben Stiller, and he's doing Ben Stiller stuff. But I never got that in Royal Tenenbaums, which is a little different.
But he doesn't anchor the movie.
Right.
It's not the Royal Chazzy.
Right.
I guess I'm a Ben Stiller apologist.
No, he's like, great. He's great. Like, we're talking about whether or not we can like a movie if it has unlikable characters or predominantly or the main character is an asshole.
I love assholes. Love them.
Right.
The more assholes in a movie, the more I'm enjoying this stuff. You heard me.
Yeah, I did, but I was
especially
trying to
Caligula. All right, yeah, it's for you.
Resist. Yeah, exactly.
There are definite, and I know this because I recently rewatched Margot at the Wedding, and there are definite sort of details that Noah Baumbach puts in his characters that I recognized that he's reusing. For one, characters writing letters. Jack Black in Margot at the Wedding, he's constantly writing angry letters, and at one point, I think Jennifer Jason Leigh says about him, he can take a week to write a letter about a music review or something. I mean, that's part of what he does. Characters who can't swim. There's also the scene.
See, I identify with that too.
Where the boy falls in the pool and can't swim. And the whole thing about not driving. And I guess that's more of like a New Yorker detail.
Squid and the Whale, the kid spreading his semen on the library books is kind of like writing letters. That's sort of what Ben Stiller was doing in Greenberg.
It's a metaphorical.
Yeah.
Okay.
Same principle.
I want to ask you guys about a couple of things.
Mm-hmm.
What did you think about the editing in that first kids' party scene?
I'm not sure what you're asking.
Kelly Wand, I think this might be a trick question, like where Dingus got upset about the lighting.
The weather,
education. Yeah.
Well, is this going to do with the devil kid and then there's a devil puppet later? Does that have anything to do with that?
No, but I do love when he calls.
A flash devil?
This is another question I have for you, but when he calls. Later, when he calls Beth and he says, "Is it Flash or the devil?" And she goes, "Yes."
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, vaguely.
It's just his basic understanding of relationships. Every relationship has a different importance to him than it had to anybody else. And their scene is phenomenal for his understanding of their relationship.
See, they're perfect for each other because all she wants is contact and all he does is bitch and moan about everything. So they're perfect for each other. They're going to last way longer than Tom gives them credit.
So before Dingus, you tell us about the editing in the party scene, I do want to say another way to make a movie about an asshole is to give him his comeuppance like he got in the scene where he's trying to reestablish contact with Beth. And he tries to ask her out. She just shoots him down.
Yes.
That's a terrible idea.
Yeah, yeah. She was just so unintentionally brutal in that scene.
Yeah.
She just missed him.
Yeah.
Now, I wanted to ask, that's one of the things I wanted to ask is, you know, Jennifer Jason Leigh was one of the writers on this, or at least she came up with a story.
Mm-hmm. She wanted to do that one scene really badly.
Well, she's married to Noah Baumbach.
She's married to who?
The director. And the writer.
I didn't know that either. I think she's out of place in that scene, or that scene feels overly long because she's in it.
No. It's awesome.
Do you mean the party scene, Dingus, or the dinner,
wherever they are at that restaurant?
I didn't think so. I thought it was lovely. I didn't.
Okay.
That's one of the best scenes in the movie, I thought. I'm surprised you think that. What do you mean too long, though? That's a very specific charge against that beautiful scene.
But by too long, I meant that it went on too long.
Remember how it ends? Like, she's talking to the waiter in mid-sentence off camera.
It does kind of abruptly cut, yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
It was all
it just felt like an odd bit of casting just because she had written the movie, and so she's like, I want to jump in here. It just didn't work for me, but that's fine.
Do you not like her? I mean, I don't mean like personally, but like, are you?
He was distracted because it was Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Well, that's what I wonder. Are you not a Jennifer Jason Leigh fan? Because I love her, and that's part of what I loved so much about Margot at the Wedding.
No, I like her a great deal. Okay. I just didn't think she fit, and her glasses were very distracting to me.
Glasses.
He is so shallow. He's just like Greenberg.
I am.
So what's your deal with the editing of the part?
Oh, yes.
Oh, because they jump cut or they intercut conversations in a non-sequential format. Is that what you're talking about, Dingus?
Absolutely. It's like no other scene in the movie, and I'm fascinated by it. And I'm not complaining about it. I just need some help with it.
Because he's freaking out being back here, and it's not like his state of mind freaking out.
That might be part of it. I mean, he's having a hard time. He doesn't want to be there. But it's a very weird non-linear editing within one scene. I don't know if you can call it a scene or a sequence. But, you know, he's having a conversation with Beth, and then he sees Beth coming, and somebody points her out to him while he's in a conversation with somebody else. And the scene flows. It has an interesting flow, but it's very awkward and very jumpy. And it has a weird I'm just very interested in contrasting the two party scenes in view of not only our later 3x3, but just in view of the different drugs he's on. So he's on pharmaceutical drugs in one scene, and he's on a different kind of drugs in another. And the parties are edited very differently. And the way that kids' party is edited is such a sore thumb for me. Right. And I don't necessarily mean that. I don't mean that pejoratively. I don't mean to say that it sticks out in a bad way, but it sticks out. And I was wondering if that had any impact on you guys. Obviously, it didn't, since you were both like, what are you talking about?
Well,
there was subliminal editing in the other party scene, so it was obviously just a mirror of – it was what Tom was saying, that he was freaking out on the drug, I thought.
Yeah, I remember it now that you mentioned it, Dingus, but yeah, I just got the sense that
it was intentional.
Yeah, because he's freaking out, because he doesn't want to be there, because he's having these weird conversations he doesn't really know how to deal with.
It's certainly intentional. It's just an odd choice.
Right.
And I'm not saying I didn't like it. I just need some help sort of sussing it out. Because you definitely see him having a conversation with her, and then he's talking with Mark Duplass, and then somebody points her out to him, and then he first sees her. But he's already had a conversation with her. And then there's a moment where he's standing in the middle of the party alone. And then it's very weird editing for that particular scene.
It's right. How parties feel. You're just like, oh, I'm over here. Now I'm in this spot at the stupid party.
I've never felt nonlinear at a party.
Oh, I do every party. Oh, are you sober?
Right now or at a party?
I don't know. Isn't this a party? I brought mine. Am I there? On acid right now. What was in the pool?
A capybara.
Okay.
It was Jesse's hand.
Jesse James?
I apologize.
I'm just assuming it was like a possum or something. I love how indeterminate that was, by the way. Just a dead creature in there.
But it was so weird. Its eye was in the wrong place. It did have a possum. I've got a possum wandering around outside my office right now because I've got some cats outside that I normally feed. So I've got a family of possum that are out here. And I immediately thought of possum, but it looked so disjointed and weird.
So that whole party scene where he's starting to get out of control and he gets in a kind of a fight with the other kids and he's freaking out and they're kind of laughing at him.
Yeah,
that actually reminded me in a way of
Shoe Club.
That tone of dread in Margot at the Wedding.
Yeah.
With all of these weird disparate elements that you don't know where they belong and are they going to turn out to be more dire or ominous. I loved that party scene. That was a great, I mean, as far as the structure of the movie, that was kind of the climax. I mean, that was his big emotional outburst. That was where things, I think, could have taken the darkest turn. Cause she's already in the hospital and it's right. The next morning that he basically ditches her again and he's going to run off to Australia.
Yeah.
And yeah, and with all the kids and also the confusion, too, because I think we've all been there. The confusion, too, about, you know, kids these days and what are all these, like, beautiful young 20-year-olds talking about and what are they doing? And
they're in a house he's house-sitting at, so he's not sure what is he the den mother?
I love the way that it transformed this safe space that he'd been in. I mean, they literally invaded.
Yeah. And it happened instantly. Like, you didn't even see how it happened. Like, there's two.
Right, right.
And then the next shot, he's surrounded by hundreds of kids. Like Logan's Run.
Well, there was always that sense of danger because of the people out in the pool. That somehow that was going to intrude. And then you're right. It was like a dam bursting.
Well, but the people out at the pool, I don't think, to the audience, I mean, they freaked him out. But to the audience, you know, what was notable about them is they were actually very friendly people. Like, they seemed very nice, and I think those scenes were shot.
And they got a hoot out of him.
Right, I think those scenes were shot to where if you were inside the house and you saw those people out at your pool, you'd be like, oh, hey, I want to go out. And they seem like they're having fun. I want to go out and be with them. You know, there was nothing ominous about them. They seemed very inviting. But the kids at the party, that was another weird thing. Like, I really thought, okay, we're going to see him get beat up. You know, we're going to see him totally freak out. Or
he does get beat up briefly, comically.
Well, he gets pushed over.
And just disappears.
Yeah, he gets knocked out of frame, basically.
And on that day.
What I liked was his sort of understanding of him being a novelty. You know, they like me, but I'm
somebody. Hey, look, it's Greenberg.
I'm a bear to be poked.
Yeah, it was bear. There was a bear baiting.
That guy's always complaining and writing the letters to Starbucks. Let's give him some coke, see what he does. Hey, look, he's Duran Duraning.
Like the Macy's DC.
Yeah. That's how I am when I go to those parties. So, I every scene was like, yep.
Do you guys remember the very first and last lines of the movie?
Uh,
I I certainly remember the last line of the movie.
Do you remember the first line of the movie?
It's one of the kids. No, no, it's let me in.
Yeah, are you going to let me in?
Are you going to let me in? Which she says twice, doesn't she?
She does get, there's another scene where they, yeah, where
don't let
she
her
does
in.
That. But the very first line and the very last line of the movie, I loved how they were very, very important statements as, about what the movie was doing, but they weren't delivered as such. They were delivered as throwaway lines that did not mean what they were saying. So the very first line, and they're both Florence, the very first line is, are you going to let me in? And the very last line is, this is
okay,
you.
Okay, this is you, yeah.
Yeah. And that's kind of the arc of the movie right there. That's her starting point and her end point. And,
even though she kind of disappears in the third act for a little bit, because Greenberg goes on his little binge.
Well, I really think that this I can't help but think this is part of what happens when he does a joint project with Jennifer Jason Leigh, where she's like – and it's a little odd to see because Squid and the Whale is so much about men, about boys and men. But then Margot at the Wedding and again, I think Jennifer Jason Leigh – did she co-write that? I'm not sure. But that's a much more sort of female-centric movie. You know, that's about two sisters. And then Greenberg is sort of equally, you know, about a guy and a girl. And Florence's character, I just felt so just really just felt just very fleshed out. I mean, it was partly the actress, but also the writing. This wasn't just some – you know what I think of? This movie
well, – he wrote the screenplay. He's – his name is – right. Like, they story together, but
right,
yeah, they.
This movie reminded me a lot of Punch Drunk Love in terms of how you basically have a weird, sometimes unlikable character who's hard to understand, but the movie isn't going to give us a break. You know, the movie's going to make us look at this quirky character, and it's about the character finding a relationship with someone who, in a way, you're thinking doesn't. Really deserves someone better. But the difference between Punch Drunk Love and this is I felt Emily Watson's character in Punch Drunk Love wasn't anywhere near as well fleshed out as Florence was in Greenberg. She shared a lot of sort of emotional weight of the movie in a way that the female character didn't in Punch Drunk Love.
And so you're attributing that to Jennifer Jason Leigh's influence.
Well, I just got to wonder, you know, is this what it's like, yeah, when he's basically co-creating a story?
Well, who wrote Margot at the Wedding? The girly one.
He did, but I don't know if Jennifer Jason Leigh also has a story credit or not.
You know, some guys can write decent chicks, dude. Just saying.
Right. Well, and even, you know, Laura Linney in Squid and the Whale is very good, too. I mean, that she's, again, not just placeholder. Yeah, you know what? Maybe he just does great female characters.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Well, I really like that Punch Drunk Love link that you just made. But, I think the relationship in that is it's more about two people who find each other who fit. I mean, it's like an atom coming together. I mean, they fit. They just click together.
In
Punch Drunk Love. And this is about two people who kind of fit, but they're going to kind of keep bumping off of each other. And
they fit by the process of elimination.
But the visual things that interest me in what you just said, there are these two things. In part of is what you just mentioned, the will you let me in at the beginning. You have three sequences where she's driving and it's showing her in profile, and you have two of them. She says, "Are you going to let me in?" But two of them are really just like extreme close-ups almost of her profile as she's driving. Mm-hmm. And the second one in particular, which is a little bit later in the movie, has this weird sort of almost soft focus but odd visual feel that reminds me, now that you say it, of Punch Drunk Love. And it's just her driving and her in profile, and you don't really see anything but her driving in profile. And it's interesting that we spend this much time with her. And I really like that.
Yeah,
because it doesn't feel like it's just him and she's a cursory character. She's important. She's the first person we see. We see her with her friend Gina. We see her singing. We see her walking. We see her giving to him when she first comes to the house and sort of being in control of the situation and then giving up that control. I love her as a character.
Well, and she arguably is much more, as far as what she's going through, much more dynamic than Greenberg. I feel. I mean, she it is her arc.
Right.
And he's sort of the interloper. He's the jerk she's going to end up dating for however long.
He's her deus ex machina.
Yeah.
And her MacGuffin.
1, 2, 3, not only you and me, got 180 degrees and I'm caught in between. Counting 1, 2, 3, Peter Pan, that's free, getting down with 3 feet.
So I could talk Greenberg longer, but let's do a 3x3. You guys okay with that?
Just see Greenberg.
Yeah, if you're just now tuning in, see Greenberg, we loved it, and we think you will too.
Especially if you're an asshole.
Yeah, so movies about and for a-holes. Kelly Wan, what do you got for us this week for our 3x3?
What I came up with, I got the sense you were disappointed when I came up with this. Especially
me?
After your, yeah.
Why do you say that?
Because you were really quiet. Like,
I write these down so that I can post them.
Oh, that was stuck.
That's me taking notes.
Why didn't I hear you typing? Typing awful quiet. So I thought that was some disappointed Keith strokes I was listening to.
He's writing on a post-it note. That's why you don't hear it.
OG. So top three drug use scenes in movies. Although in hindsight, I wish I'd just called it drug trips and stuck you guys with having actually come up with stuff.
All right. Well, yeah, you went with drug use, so.
Well,
yeah, you didn't specify scenes, I don't think.
Oh, what did I say? Movie, scene, drug trip.
Just depictions of drug use. And it could have been a whole movie or a mood. Now you're saying it's scenes.
I don't remember what I said. I was on drugs when I came up with it.
I think it was depictions of drug use, yeah.
I actually said the word depictions.
Maybe portrayals.
Pretty proud of myself.
I think you said thingies or dinguses.
I guess
all right.
I'm a real movie critic.
And Dingus, since you are giving us our 3x3 for next week, you start out. What is your number three depiction of drug use?
Wait, I'm starting? Yeah, you're right. All right, I think I'm going to go. I'm going to throw you guys a curveball and give you a quote.
Okay.
Kirby.
All right, you ready?
Ready. Rock and roll.
Now I am.
Here we go. But I don't like the idea of taking something if I don't know what it is. I don't want anyone to try to slip me saltpeter, you know what I mean?
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest?
Very good, Kelly Wong.
Wait, right. What drug is he on? I don't remember that.
He's not on drugs at that point. In fact, it's him avoiding using drugs. And it's the way, when we talked about drug use, I started thinking about the way drugs are used to control people. And I sort of thought about Shutter Island, and then that made me think about how much I wanted to pick this film and how much I love this film. So this is One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest from 1975, directed by Milos Forman. And it's just sort of the use of medication, because you had said that we could go with pharmaceuticals as well. So the use of medication to control people and how that's a dynamic between the characters in this film, and specifically how Nurse Ratched uses it as a power play, and offers it as sort of you don't have to take it orally kind of thing, and then how Murphy, what Murphy does after that, I don't want to give too much away, but I just.
Don't give away Unflow the Cuckoo's.
35-year-old movie. Wow.
Not everybody's seen that, yeah.
Well, not everybody has, sorry. But I love the – I just – when I think about this movie, it has a medicated feel to me. And I think it's perfectly juxtaposed to the – to the one I chose as my number one. So I just love the medicated feel to this movie, and so that's the one I chose as my number three.
I'm the Billy Bibbit of the podcast.
I'm going to tell your mom.
Oh. Spoilers.
Well, that's an interesting way to kick off our definition of drug use.
Yeah. It's curveball. He's right. So they don't, they don't actually take drugs in the movie, do they?
Well, they're medicating the inmates. I mean, they definitely. I don't know what they. Some sort of, I don't know what they were doing back in the 70s. This is before Reagan sent all of them home. they're definitely, they're medicating them. And Dingus, to escape, doesn't how do they stop taking the medication? Like, isn't that a big deal? Is at one point, like, is Jack Nicholson, like, palming the drugs or something? Or what happens at the end?
Well, essentially, well, I'm not going to give away what happens at the end. But the thing is, what you have to understand about it is that he's not really a mental patient. He's gone there to avoid going to prison. So avoiding taking the drugs is of utmost importance to him, not only because he's worried about inhibition of his sexual drive, but because he's worried about becoming catatonic. And you see that in the other patients and the rebellion that he incites within the hospital is partly because he is palming or under his tonguing or whatever he's doing to avoid taking the medication.
And who wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, speaking of drug use?
Ken Kesey. So
Ken Kesey, yeah.
Very good.
But he never took drugs. I don't know what you're talking about.
All right, well, it'll be interesting to see where you go from there, Dingus. What I did with my list, I have pretty strong feelings about drug use, and a lot of it comes from my own personal history. When I was younger, I was definitely of the opinion that it, you know, opened the doors of perception and freed your mind and removed contrived societal inhibitions and yada, yada, yada. But I like to think I kind of grew out of that. now I tend to sort of have a more negative view of drug use. And not that I always abstain. I mean, I think there's a difference between drug abuse and drug use. But generally, I kind of frown on drug use. And I don't.
Except ones with coffee in them.
Well, you know what? I've even as recently as a few years ago recreationally enjoyed a little Vicodin. You know, I'm no Puritan, but I don't think
wow.
that. Yeah, how about that?
Wow, you're hardcore. Man.
I know.
Can you get me some?
But what I was looking for in my portrayals of drug use for my three choices were movies that reflected how I feel about drugs, and that's namely. That they aren't, you know, Hollywood loves to portray drugs as either entirely funny, super cool, or entirely dire. You know, where drug use in any use of drugs is the beginning of this almost apocalyptic spiral into self destruction. You know, that I think is guff. But then on the other hand, I'm not super fond of glamorizing drug use. But I think there's a role for it in some people's lives. So that's what I was looking for. I was trying to find middle ground where it wasn't, drug use isn't something that automatically makes you a junkie, but it's also not something that you should necessarily treat lightly. And I also don't always like when it defines the character. So anyway, I sort of had a lot of tap dancing around to do for my three. So my number three choice, and I'll give you guys a line. Are you ready? Trains are cool. So are horses.
Hmm.
No one?
Greenberg?
So the station agent is about three characters who really have nothing in common. And it's about how they come together. It's a character study, basically, of these three characters. And at one point, they shoot a movie. One of the characters is a train enthusiast. And they shoot a movie of... they're chasing it's called, I think, train chasing or something. They're basically driving along a train, and they shoot a little handheld movie of it. And they all gather at Patricia Clarkson's house to watch the movie that they've shot. And there's a cut to, you know, they're cooking dinner, and they're having drinks, and then there's a cut to them watching the movie. And Peter Dinklage is smoking a cigarette, and Bobby Cannavale says something about trains are cool. And Peter Dinklage says, so are horses. They give him a look. He says, well, that's what I was thinking. And Bobby Cannavale leans over and says, give me the joint. And it was just a cigarette that he was smoking. And what it is, it's just three people who have gotten together to celebrate. And part of, you know, their celebration is they drink and they also, you know, they get stoned and they watch their movie. It doesn't define who they are. It doesn't – I don't think there's any other time in the movie that references drug use. But it's just part of this light, funny, recreational moment that they have. And what follows that scene is – this very uncharacteristic openness between Peter Dinklage and Patricia Clarkson, where in the aftermath of that kind of buzz and that night of being a little stoned and a little tipsy, they really open up to each other and they connect in a very beautiful way. So I just loved how getting stoned, how marijuana was just a little bit of a a little bit of spice on that scene. It sort of unlocked it and gave it a little flavor. So that's my number three, is the station agent. All right, over to you, Kelly Wand. What do you got for us?
Was the flavor it gave Grape Ape?
I don't know what it means, but no.
It was garlic, actually.
Do you have a garlic press?
My number
Kelly Wand, have you seen the station agent?
No.
All right.
It's the one with Dinklage, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
How dare you?
Is it good?
It was my favorite movie of the year, yes.
Really?
Paul McCarthy is really an excellent writer and director. Have you seen The Visitor?
No.
Okay. Well, Tom McCarthy, you know, he's one of those guys where if his name is on a movie, I can't wait to see it. Station Agent, Visitor, I heartily recommend to you.
Have you heard of Up?
Yeah.
So he co-wrote Up with the Pixar guys. Up, actually, is it a story credit, Dingus?
I have no idea.
Yeah. But I think the emotional gravitas in Up, I think you can attribute that to Tom McCarthy's input, at least part of that. So, All right. So there you go. Those are three recommendations, Kelly Wand. Well, you've seen Up, but now see Station Agent and The Visitor.
That was your favorite movie of the year, huh? All right.
Station Agent? Yeah.
It's brilliant. It's brilliant, yeah. And it's a good choice. I really like that. I like that whole thing about the horse. Nice.
Is it a period piece?
Nope. Modern day.
Someday it will be.
It's give it about 20 years. All right, Kelly Wand, what is your number three? Can't wait to see what you've come up with.
All right, here's a quote from my number three.
Okay.
You drive. I think there's something wrong with me.
See, I'm afraid if I start guessing, I'm going to preempt people's choices. So I'm just going to say I don't recognize that line.
I think I do, but I'm with Tom. I don't want to preempt. Go ahead, Kelly Wand.
I hate to say this, but this place is getting to me. I think I'm getting the fear.
Well, there you go. Yeah. You know, I why didn't I even think of that one? I guess it's just too over the top, and it's part of a little bit of what I'm talking about with glamorizing drug use.
But that's a great... it does both, though, because the whole movie, like the last third of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas by Terry Gilliam, is kind of a bummer, and it was written that way on purpose by Terry Gilliam and I forget.
But it has one of my favorite drug-involved lines, and that's what almost led me to take it, just because I love that line so much.
Which one?
Tom?
Did you see what God just did to us?
That wasn't God. That was you.
So you guys like that movie?
I love Fear and Loathing.
Yeah, me too.
Fear and Loathing is easily. I mean, the thing is, it's not quite Gilliam. I mean, it's Gilliam just doing Hunter S. Thompson justice. I mean, it doesn't feel like pure Gilliam, and that's part of its brilliance. And it's also so actor driven. I mean, it's so Johnny Depp and Guillermo del Toro. Just riffing on each other. I mean, it is brilliant on so many levels. I love Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
It's an underrated movie, and it's got a lot of cameos in it, and it's got Muppets, and Hunter Thompson's in it. I don't know. It felt like a drug trip, and it felt like the good and the bad of a drug trip.
Yeah.
It's fun for a little bit, and then you kind of wish it was still an hour ago for about an hour.
Well, it definitely, you know what, you're right, Kelly Wand. It definitely does not downplay. I mean, it gets really dark, and it's got a you know, it's got a very sort of wistful, almost like Withnail and I ending, where it's a real bummer at the end, isn't it?
Yeah. It's got to come down. So it does both of the things you were saying.
Yep.
Where it glamorizes it and then kind of takes it apart.
Good call. I mean, that's the sort of movie that as soon as I start talking about it, I'm like, I'm going to go in the living room and watch that right now.
Yeah, you watch it sober, so you must really like it.
All right. Good work.
All right.
Dingus, what's your number two?
That's my only good one, by the way.
Oh, come on. Well, why did you pick for your number one? The other two have got to be better than that. I can't wait to see what you've come up with.
Were you just one trying to preempt us?
Yeah. I wanted to get that one. Right.
All right.
I wanted to have one good one so the other two won't get brushed.
So you saved Cannonball Run for one of your first two, then.
Oh, you're close. Closer than you know.
Zap and Cannonball Run.
Oh.
What's your number two, Dingus?
I want to hear about Tom's seedy background that he's talking about. So.
Well, I was a stoner. I mean, I went through. I was one of those guys. I just the place to talk about this, but no, I went through high school. You know, basically being stoned every day for many years of my life.
Well, look, it helped you though.
I totally disagree.
You're a pretty articulate dude for a guy who's.
Well, thank you, but I really feel strongly that if I had not
stopped.
If I hadn't gotten stoned so much in high school, I think I would be in a very different place in my life.
Really?
Yeah, I don't regard it as a positive at all. Yeah.
Wow. Interesting. Where do you think you would be without if it hadn't been for the devil weed?
Well, I really do feel, I mean, marijuana recreationally, I don't have any problem with it. But I think in the process of an education and being a kid and learning about stuff, I mean, I really do think that it sapped a lot of motivation I should have had. I just think it was not a productive use of my time when I was that age.
But it probably led you to games, and then you would have been a lawyer otherwise.
Maybe.
Well, that wouldn't have been better for society. Pot redeemed you, and you don't even know it.
Could be.
It's your Florence.
You know, we'll talk about it my number two. We'll get back
all
to
right,
it.
All right, so, sorry, Dingus.
All right, Dingus, what's your number two?
Okay, yeah, I'm going to take us totally. I'm just going to derail us completely with this. And here's my quote, as is my wont.
Wow. Are you stoned, Dingus, right now?
Okay, do you know what that's from?
do that again.
Quest for Fire?
Was that actually the line? Or wait, did I screw up? I thought you screwed the line up.
I did. I totally flubbed.
Oh, okay.
I didn't even flub it. I just went, hey, hey.
Because then you did judo on me, and I thought that was actually the line, and I'd made fun of you too early for screwing it up, but you didn't.
Because Tom doesn't smoke pot anymore. That's why I got the joke.
All right, Dingus, what's the line? Take two.
I got a little hungry. Sorry.
Go ahead. Munch away.
The munchies,
here's the line. This is the perfect movie for your crunching. Well, here we are in the Munchcast. The line is, he who can destroy a thing controls a thing.
Dune.
Yep, there you go.
Ah, good choice.
Dingus.
What?
I see what you've done, Kelly. Dingus is just...
No way, that was a great one.
Whatever.
Oh, did you see Dune was in Greenberg? Did you see that he was writing on...
Yes, that was so awesome.
Absolutely.
So wasn't it Children of Dune, though?
Yeah, it was Children of Dune.
Yeah.
I was totally thinking, like, why is that in the movie? Wait, yeah. That's the one where he takes all the drugs and becomes the sandworm. Because I read four of them. How far into Dune did you guys get? See, I see the movie on a whole other level.
All right, well, Dingus, do you want to explain to us what Dune has to do with drug use?
Not really. I'm just so pleased with that your reactions were exactly what I was expecting.
Really? Oh, I'm stoked. I can't wait.
Dingus is not only gaming the list, he's gaming me.
Yeah.
Okay, I will explain a little bit about this 1984 movie directed by David Lynch. It's a terrible movie.
What?
Well, I hate it. Let me just say, I hated it when I saw it in the theater because I loved the book so much, the first book. I think I hung through part of Messiah. And my father and I went to see it, and I was just so disappointed by it. And I think it's horrible, but I've just established – I've grown to be fond of it over the years. My friend Aaron gave me a copy of it a couple years ago for my birthday.
Billy and I've watched it too.
Yeah, I've watched it a few times, and I can't help but be fond of it. And I really can't divorce from the source material how drugs are. But I just like the depiction of drug use in this. I like how it's
a part of the Aaron.
Right. It's different from most sci-fi, which just have this random drug called ice something or other, or it's just some sort of motivator for the plot. But this is very much an understanding of the economics of drugs in the entire universe,
mm-hmm.
In the context of this story, from the economic power of the spice to the
religious
drink,
too.
Exactly, to the drinking. Right, the drinking of the water of life and how it affects him. This just works for me in this film. And it's one of the few things in this film that really does work for me and that I liked. And so when I thought about this list, I couldn't help but choose Dune.
I think it's a brilliant choice, and Tom's high for not agreeing.
Oh, it's drugs.
Yeah.
Thanks, David Lynch.
And it's like sand. It's like spice is kind of like sand, so you have to, like, dig for it in the sand.
Now, Kelly Wand, you might know this, but isn't a lot of this, like, 60s sci-fi stuff, isn't a lot of this stuff...
I grok what you're asking.
Good Lord, yeah. How about that? Wow. That's can't even believe. Yeah. But it's all rooted, like, isn't that Frank Herbert stuff from, like, 60s drug counterculture, like...
No.
Weren't those science fiction writers into all that stuff?
Frank Herbert wasn't. His stuff's really dry. It's like, that's what's weird about Dune, is like his writing style is like sand getting in your eyes. And the drug scene simply is like an economic, it's a tool. And like, it's not really, I don't know.
So he's not coming then out of drug counterculture from the 60s and trying to talk about how, you know, spice and drugs will broaden your mind.
No.
It wasn't, okay. So it'll turn you into a worm.
Yeah, but it won't broaden your mind. It'll make you live longer, but it'll ruin your mind.
Well, don't the Bene Gesserit, like, don't they use spice to see the future and whatnot? Or?
Yeah, another the guild uses it to teleport ships.
Oh, right.
And the Fremen use it to trip out.
So it will broaden your mind.
Sandworm.
Yeah, it's totally this drug counterculture, like, it's just drug apology.
But this is a mythical drug, Tom. It's a fictitious drug that we don't have access to.
But isn't that the whole point of, isn't that the point of a lot of science fiction, is to comment on contemporary issues in a different hypothetical setting?
Yeah, but I can get that from Dune.
Okay.
I really got from Dune, it was just a story about a bunch of random shit that happens 10,000 years now.
Okay.
And that's
Wait, 10,000 years ago?
In the future.
Oh, in the future. Oh, right. So Dune is like this, like, is Earth in Dune?
It's not a stony book. It's not like a Philip K. Dick, Palmer Eldritch kind of thing.
Okay.
Which I think is what you're thinking of.
Okay.
I'm thinking of Philip K. Dick.
All right.
But drugs also have more of an economic equivalent to oil in some ways.
Oh, it's oil.
Thank you, James Cameron. Because when the Fremen, when they're going to withhold the spice from, what's going to cause the toppling of the economy, because you're not going to be able to fold space anymore and a variety of things are going to happen.
Right, but that's not a 60s thing, I wouldn't say.
Okay,
no.
So Tom's right and wrong. He was talking about social issues, but... I don't know. I think you start with that stuff, and then the story takes over.
Right.
That's good. I don't know. Tom did read Dune. That's so
no, weird. No, I read Dune. No, I loved Dune.
And that was
when I was a kid.
Yeah. But isn't the first half really boring? And then it kind of...
Oh, no, not the movie.
Halfway through.
Are we talking about the book or the movie now? Because I agree with Dingus that the movie's wretched. Yeah, the book. No, I have not read the book since I was a kid, but I did love it when I was a kid.
I read four of them. Which to me was not a sign of approval.
Have you read any of the ones that his kid finished?
No. I feel I should read the last two, but then I'd have to start all over, and who has time for that? I don't know. I didn't care. I didn't like him as much as Tom did. I didn't love Dune. I just felt like I needed it under my belt. To
broaden your horizons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was one of my least favorite. I thought it was one of the most overrated, must-read, like, Stranger in a Strange Land was way druggier, and Heinlein was a total...
See, I guess I'm thinking of Heinlein.
Yeah, but he wasn't a druggie, so that was what was so weird about that book, was it was a hippie book written by Robert Heinlein.
Right.
And it was kind of... It was bad, too, in a lot of ways, but there's something about it. There's something about that character that's good, the Martian guy, where he teleports people away, like the cornfield. Remember that? Valentine Michael Smith. Tom's filled with hate right now.
I'm just out of my league. I'm out of my element.
You associate these science fiction novels with your drug era, so now you poo-poo both of them. Like, oh, science fiction, drugs, it's all. Thanks, James Cameron.
So the movie Signs is based on that, then?
What?
Sorry. You talked about a cornfield, and all I could think of was sign.
Oh.
Good Lord, wow, that was obscure.
Yeah, that's quite a leap.
Swing away, dingus.
What are you on?
Corn.
So Viking was Tom's Achilles heel. That explains so much about this podcast.
All right, I'm going to move on to my number two. You guys ready for this?
Sure.
My number two, and this is, again, because this is an instance of drug use in a child, and it's more out of a sense of youthful confusion, and it's part of growing up and sort of feeling your way in the world. And it's specifically Danny's bar mitzvah scene in A Serious Man, where it's just this confused kid, you know, dealing with, in a way, the same issues that his father's going to deal with. And there's an instance, too, of his father dallying with marijuana. It's this sort of forbidden fruit scene with the neighbor. But I just love that scene. I love how he is so befuddled, and it's this really important moment, and he's just kind of a confused good kid, but who's also getting stoned and spending money on marijuana. And then the way they shoot the scene of him unable to focus on the Torah when he's supposed to do the reading his bar mitzvah.
But he does eventually figure it.
Right, and exactly, it doesn't sabotage him.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's I think of all the times when I was stoned as a kid, and you know, going to class or whatever, and I just got away with being stoned a lot, and that's part of what you can do when you're a kid, I guess. But it's part of
being a kid.
Well, it can be, yes, and I liked the way that it was portrayed in A Serious Man as part of Danny's trying to deal with the world, finding his way in the world.
It's the last chance in your life you'll be able to get away with stuff like that.
Yep. Yeah.
If you get stoned for work, you'll always get caught. The drug test. Don't get me started.
So there's my number two, Serious Man. All right, Kelly Wand, what do you got for us?
My number two is Scatman Crothers. That's not the name of the movie. That's the.
I think I've seen one movie with Scatman Crothers.
We've all seen one movie with Scatman Crothers.
That's it. What else? Why else would I know who he is? Even.
You remember where he burns the weed and he smokes. He inhales the fumes from the burned weed in the basement radiator, and he dreams his wife is chasing him on a stagecoach, shooting salamis at him, because he's obsessed with salamis.
Wow. I have no idea. That's certainly not The Shining.
That's the director's cut of The Shining.
You guys haven't watched Zapped yet, after all I've said about Zapped?
Is this from Zapped?
Yeah.
Z-A-P-T.
I was right? Yes. You nailed me.
Wait.
But it's totally extraneous, and that's why it's always stuck in my head, is because it has nothing to do with the rest of the movie. Because the movie's about Scott Baio getting telekinesis and using it to see boobs. But they're also growing weed in the lab for no reason, because they never smoke it or express interest in it.
Can I redo my list?
All right, that's my number two.
All right, good.
Thank you.
Yeah.
He dreams his wife is shooting salamis at him?
Yeah, that's his bad trip on weed. Scatman Crothers.
I'm not sure I'd want his wife shooting salamis at me either. That is a nightmare scenario.
Yeah. So that's the movie that led me to weed, a gateway drug. And it's
because you love salami?
No, because I love Scatman. And I wanted to be a janitor when I grew up. Oh, wait, he's a coach. I can't remember.
Jeez. All right.
Anyway, Zapped. Don't miss it.
The Dingus, what is your number one?
Available on DVD from Amazon. Zapped. I'm done.
I don't know how to follow that.
Yeah. All right.
All right, my number one is obvious, and this sort of speaks to why limiting the category. Well, I found it incredibly amusing that Kelly Wine said he wasn't going to limit it because he's not a total dick last week. Why limiting the category eliminates having to include this movie, and I could have included something else, but I couldn't avoid including this movie because there was no limitation on the category. When I think of best depictions of drug use, I can't help but think of this movie, and it's totally obvious. So here's a quote from it. Purple in the morning, blue in the afternoon, orange.
Best movie ever.
That was my favorite that year as well.
Yeah. That's my number two.
But which depiction, Dingus? There were several depictions of drug use in that.
The whole movie and the deleted scenes.
Well, no. I'm the two specific things I'm thinking.
We should say the movie, by the way.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Requiem for a Dream from 2000, directed by Darren Aronofsky. As soon as Kelly Wan said this category, I just got the mental image of the dilating pupil and the and I can't get that out of my head. And this is why I mentioned earlier it's sort of juxtaposed against One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, because One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is very clean and medical, and this is very dirty and grimy. And ironically enough, one of my favorite depictions of drug use in this movie is the mother and her cleaning, and how crazy she gets when she's on drugs, as opposed to what's happening with her son. But I would just say her cleaning, and then just the image of that eye, and the sound effect that goes along with it. And that's really all I've got. And I have a list of other films that I was going to choose, but when I think of really a best depiction of drug use, I can't get away from this film. It's just a phenomenal film.
And I'm static,
really. Yeah, 9 out of 10 cats agree.
What part of what I think it does so well, Dingus, is, and specifically with Jared Leto and Jennifer Connelly when they're fixing, is this idea of it's almost a ritual. It's just these quick little things that you do to get to that moment. This quick sequence of jump cuts, and it's okay, do step A, then step B, then step D, and you got to do that, and then, okay, finally. And the way Darren Aronofsky cut those together was just so just kinetic and just felt really just sharp. I mean, I loved that.
And how he does it with her with the mom's descent, where her food just disappears instantly because she's so hungry. She's first doing the diet before the...
All right.
She's on
right.
The pill. That's the greatest movie ever made.
I think Hugh Selby Jr. deserves a lot of credit for that. I mean, that's such a great cinematic representation of the kind of stuff that he does. I mean, he just does these it's just like, you know, New York City as hell kind of stories.
Yeah. Who thought the Wayans would be in the best movie?
Oh, that's right. I forgot about him. Wow.
He's amazing in it.
He is, isn't he?
They're all amazing.
Totally forgot about that. Yeah.
That's my number two. I'm totally taken zapped off.
What's your number one then? Oh, wait, it's my turn.
Mm-hmm.
My number one is a movie that I know you've seen, Dingus. I doubt you've even heard of it, Kelly. It's a scene where, so both Station Agent and Serious Man are just marijuana, but this is a scene with heroin, and it's a couple of characters. So often in a movie, when a character uses heroin, it defines that character. You know, the movie is about a heroin junkie. But in this movie, it's a scene where some friends are visiting the two characters. And the friends are in from the big city, and they bring heroin with them. And they're like, hey, y'all want to shoot up? And so they all shoot up, but it portrays the drug use as something that stems from boredom and aimlessness. It's just something that people sometimes do, like having sex or fixing dinner or smoking cigarettes or going through a difficult breakup. It's just part of the human condition for some people. And it's a one scene. They don't do heroin anymore in the movie. And it's one scene in a movie called Praise, which is just about this relationship. And it's these two characters in Brisbane, and when their friends come from Sydney with heroin, they shoot up and then they move on. And I loved how kind of matter of fact it was. It wasn't judgmental. They didn't then become junkies and spiral into a cycle of self-destruction. It didn't glamorize it. It wasn't like a fun, wacky drug trip like Big Lebowski or something. I just loved how matter of fact it was. So there's my number one, is the heroin scene in Praise.
Praised or Praise?
Praise. So it's based on a novel, this sort of grunge novel by Andrew McGahan, I'm not sure how to say his name, which delves a lot more into the drug use and slacker culture and whatnot. But in the movie, it's just one scene. And it's called Praise. You haven't seen that, right, Kelly Wand?
No.
Okay.
It's just such a beautiful movie.
Yeah.
It's a great choice. I had actually totally forgotten that. I can't help but think about smoking whenever I think of that movie, but it's just because of the poster, I think.
All right, Kelly. So
I noticed the theme of Tom's is ones that make drug use seem incidental to the characters' lives.
Yep. It doesn't define the character.
Right.
Doesn't. Right. Yeah. and it doesn't necessarily judge it as something harsh or terrible. Yeah.
Well, it didn't define Scatman Crothers, but it did define Ellen Hurst.
Did anyone here see the thing with Steve Martin and Meryl Streep and Alec Baldwin where they got an R rating because they get stoned? Like, what was that? It's Complicated?
Yeah.
Did anyone see that?
No. Did you?
Well, no, but I'm curious when I think about my list, I'm curious what – because apparently there's a scene where they just get stoned and it got them an R rating because it doesn't show any negative consequence of the getting stoned.
Jesus Christ.
Just curious.
Is that
about
the rule? That's a whole rating?
Didn't we talk about that? Yeah. I think that was the kerfluffle about that movie. Got an R rating because there was an incidence of drug use without showing any negative consequence of it. But I'm okay. You know, an R rating, I'm okay with that. That's what we talked about it in the context that we talked about it on the podcast before.
I don't like ratings.
All right.
Although I guess I do, because if it's got an R rating, it usually has some weed in it. So you should...
What's your number one choice of drug use depiction in a movie, Kelly Wong? Pharmaceutical or otherwise?
The first line in the movie is this. The tank itself was unusual in that it was vertical and looked like an old boiler.
Train spotting.
No, good choice, though. That's what it should have been. Okay, I'm changing my number two from Requiem for a Dream. Back to Zap and then back to...
The tank itself, I don't know. I don't know a movie that opens with a discussion of a water tank.
Ah, think about it. Think about it. John Larroquette's in it. Spoiler alert.
I'm pretty sure I haven't seen it then, unless it's that thing
Drew
with
Barrymore's
Bruce Willis and Kim Basinger.
What the hell's that?
Something about they go on a date, like date night? No.
Oh, Blind Date.
Blind Date, yes. Is it Blind Date?
No. Oh, I know it. I know what you're talking about.
Are you me talking or Kelly
Wand? Kelly Wand, are you talking about a sensory deprivation tank?
Yes.
Oh, very good. Very good.
Hooray!
Blair Brown's best work since Continental Divide.
Yeah. Because Patty Chayefsky and Kent Russell, when they get together, it's murder. Okay. That wasn't the tagline. What am I saying?
Tell for people who don't know obscure William Hurt movies like we do. Tell people what the
This was William Hurt's first movie. It was made before Body Heat in 1980. I believe Body Heat was 81.
This was his first movie?
I have no idea.
His breakthrough role, and he turns into a monkey in it. Spoiler alert. It's actually not.
You still haven't said the name of it.
Altered States.
Very good.
There was like a thing at the Hollywood Wax Museum like 15, 20 years ago where they had like a horror exhibit, and the three movies you would wander through spooky scenes from were Halloween, Alien, and Altered States. Like, that was the third member of the trifecta of wax horror iconic scenes. I don't know. Not that that's why it's on my list, but...
So I have no idea why I remember this, Kelly Wand, but I remember a line from Altered States where Blair Brown is explaining to him, she says something to him like, making love to you feels like being harpooned by a mad monk. I have no idea why I remember that.
I would love to be told that.
That's something we all aspire to.
That makes me off Blair Brown. Everything does. But yeah. Do you like that movie? Am I overselling?
Oh, no, I don't remember it very well. I mean, I've seen it, but I remember liking it quite a bit. I have not seen it in a long time, and now
it's got everything, because it's got evolution. Like, he becomes – he's devolving back to protoplasm by way of Iceman and caveman-esque.
Like you do.
But there's also hell. He's taking acid going into a sensory deprivation.
Right.
So it's like that movie The Jacket, except not lame. And with Blair Brown. And
have you seen it recently, Kelly Wand?
I haven't seen it in like 6 years, but I feel like it's been too long. And it needs to be on a list.
And it is Ken Russell.
Yeah. It was Ken Russell's most popular movie. Most box office successful movie.
Okay. Good one. And is it mushrooms or acid? What is he taking when he goes into the tank?
I think he takes acid.
Okay.
I should have seen it before I put it on my list. Again. so I could talk about it more authentically. But I just feel it's the words need to be said. United States.
I still think your number three is your best, by the way.
Yeah, I forgot about Requiem. I'm
quite fond of that.
It was too soon.
All right, so there's our 3x3 for this week. Dingus, what do you have for us for next week?
All right. Can I mention – all right. I want to talk about –
Should we talk about, like, the things that didn't make our lists?
No. My list of things that didn't make it is far too long. So.
Okay. All know them. I mean, they're – yeah, there's a bazillion movies about, you know, portrayals of drug use.
What's your least favorite drug use movie? Mine'd probably be The Boost.
I really, really like the scene in Greenberg.
Yeah, me too.
I liked how it revealed him, how it sort of brought out the truth that drug use just makes jerks bigger jerks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I like how it was involved in the unfolding of that scene.
I got him back together with Florence, so drugs saved him.
I would just, by the way, we don't want to spoil stuff too much, but I would disagree with that. I find it, I really enjoy a good comical drug trip scene. And as far as those go, I really like the Busby Berkeley bit with Saddam Hussein and Julianne Moore in a Viking outfit and Big Lebowski when he gets drugged. That's just so completely off the wall. Gene Hackman detoxing in French Connection 2.
Pretty good one.
Pretty powerful stuff. Ethan Hawke's confusion in Training Day after Denzel Washington makes him smoke crack and throws him into a den with a Latino gang. There's some good stuff there. I
considered The Hangover for a while.
Martin Lawrence falling in the water in Black Knight.
I didn't see that one.
Interesting.
I was looking for quotes when we saw Repo Men last week. I found myself on YouTube looking up old clips from Repo Man. And there's some really, really great stuff of Harry Dean Stanton all coked up in Repo Man, which was a joy to watch.
I like the opening scene of Pineapple Express, too.
Oh, God, Pineapple Express is a great one. Rats.
Yeah, I thought about that. What do you guys think about American Beauty?
I don't know if that movie's good, but I like the scene where they smoke pot, actually.
Well, just the way... Well, what pot about that has scene? To do? I'm talking about what the role pot plays in his liberation, or whatever you want to call it.
It helps him.
Yeah, but is it a little too facile? I don't know.
I would say it's about as facile as the
The rest of the movie. All right. Yeah. It could have been anything. Yeah. It could have been chocolate. The way that he. When I smoke pot, the last thing I want to do is work out. So already the movie's it's already lost me. This guy's not on my side. I can't identify with this guy. I get to quitting your job and smoking pot. Working out and...
Hey, Kelly Wan, let's get baked and go lift.
What do you bench lately, Tom? I mean, ask you. My biotech stocks are on the upswing. NASDAQ. What?
All right, Dingus, give us next week's 3x3. What do you got for us?
All right, I do want to mention what I was going to go for is talk. I just want to mention briefly Greenberg, and I'm not going to give anything away other than where I'm going to just ask you guys, where is Greenberg set?
L.A.
Is there ever any doubt of that?
No?
There's proof, I thought, but I forget where it ended
up. No, there's no doubt of that. Where do you get in that, Dingus?
No, there's absolutely no doubt.
The vets are always crowded in a...
So there's never any doubt, and they don't have to show the Hollywood sign or anything like that, but there's never any doubt that we're in L.A. And so I was thinking of this as we went driving through Greenberg, as opposed to a movie we saw, at least I know Tom saw, I don't know if you've ever seen it, Kelly, called 500 Days of Summer, which is also set in Los Angeles. But you really have no idea where it's actually set until they say it's set in Los Angeles. So the 3x3 for this week is about establishing a sense of place in film. Mm. And what I want to drive at here is what films or scenes do you think are your, I don't know, your favorite or are best at establishing a sense of place? And this can be as big or as small as you want it to be. It can be a whole film or a scene. The sense of place can be, again, as large or as small as you want it to be. I'm not going to restrict it other than to say I am going to take the film Manhattan off the table, just so I don't have to pick it.
Can the place be a cube?
The place can be as big or as small as you want it to be. It doesn't have to be a country. It doesn't have to be a city. It can be whatever you want it to be. But what film or scene best for you establishes a sense of place? And so think about the differences here between places that say they're set in some place but give no real sense of that, or a place that doesn't even have to say and you know immediately where it is.
Does a spaceship that looks like Eddie Murphy count as a place?
You cannot use Scatman Crothers' poster from The Shining.
Because that establishes a hotel room like no other poster I've ever seen.
My hands are tired.
All right, good. Sounds good. So next week we'll be back with that 3x3, as well as a discussion of Clash of the Titans in 3D. Have you guys seen, by the way, the posters of the awesome facial hair that they paste onto their actors? Have you seen those beards?
Are they as good as the beards in Gettysburg?
They're getting there. The gods have beards like you would not believe. The beards they put on Ralph Fiennes and Liam Neeson, just I can't wait to see those in 3D. It's going to be amazing.
Liam Neeson's in it?
Is Katie Holmes in it?
Does she play Hera?
I don't know what you guys are talking about.
Aphrodite is the carpet match the drapes.
So I am Tom Chick. I was joined with Christian Minzinski.
Christian Morosky.
I was close. And Kelly Wand.
Greenberg. Also, caveman. That's my number two.